Hey folks, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of the Writers Panel. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks also to all of you who came out to the Thrilling Adventure Hour show at the Bourbon Room last week. It was really cool to see some listeners to the podcast and also folks who follow the Substack. That was really great. I really appreciate that. If you are curious about the show and would like to see what a good time we had, both shows, the 7 and 9 p.m. shows, are still available to stream and will be available for a couple of weeks. Just go to my Twitter. That's the best way to do it. Go to Ben Blacker. I still am on Twitter. It's the worst. Also, go over to the old newsletter, benblacker.substack.com. That's where the good stuff is. We have a couple of Q&As with professional writers coming this month, the month of July, I should say. We're making up for a few that we missed because of the strike. So we've got two Q&As that you can only attend if you are a paid subscriber at benblacker.substack.com. More information about those coming soon, but basically you all show up, you ask the questions, and you get amazing advice from pro writers who know exactly what they're doing. There's also, if I do say so myself, some good articles on there. We have a couple of conversations for you today. The first is a strike-related conversation with Adam Malinger. Adam is a writer on Superman and Lois on the CW. You also may know him as a Bitter Script Reader on Twitter. He's been doing that for many years and always has a really great perspective on the industry. He is first and foremost a fan of television, and that comes across in all of his tweets. So go check him out on Twitter and enjoy this conversation about the do's and don'ts of networking on the picket line. Union song, union battle, all added up, one is all what we got now. Union song, union battle, all added up, one is all what we got now. I can't even start to look around me here. It's good to see you. Adam, right now, you know, as both a writer on Superman and Lois. You also know Adam as a Bitter Script Reader over on Twitter and elsewhere. And that was how we first met.
I feel like we probably have a big commonality between our presence in screenwriting Twitter and social media.
That's true. That's fair. I accept that. And we did, we are going to get into Twitter because that was the sort of impetus for this conversation. But before we get into that, tell me how your brain is doing these days. We were just talking before we got recording here, and you're saying you're pretty much out on the picket line every day. How are you holding up?
The best way I can describe it is having talked to people who have done this the previous time, and they've talked about how much more solidarity there is this time and how the mood 7 weeks in is far greater than it was then. I mean, that helps because I have nothing to compare this to, obviously. You know, it's the first time we've been involved in this, and I was already on a hiatus, so it's not like I was ripped out of a writer's room and put on the street there. So I was already kind of in hiatus brain, and so this is just, I still am not working, and now I'm just doing it, walking around studio lot, surrounded by a lot of the writers. And it's sort of like that first hour of every writer's room, except there's no obligation to break story. So we just do all the fun stuff, like bitch about the shows that we were watching last night and how we would have done them better. And, you know, about it, people we've worked with, we like, and other experiences. So it's there's a social aspect to it that is keeping me sane through this. And I'm, you know, also have a certain sort of arrogant self-righteousness that we're on the right side and that we're obviously going to win. So this is just a matter of time of waiting it out because, I mean, we are right. They're going to break. There is no middle ground here. So it's just, all right, this is something we got to get through to the point where we win. So I don't know if that's mentally healthy, but that's how my brain operates in these times of stress.
I think it feels very healthy to me, honestly, like keeping that kind of optimism. You know, again, like that I wouldn't say it's righteousness, because I do think we're on the right side. I mean, I think all of the various unions and individuals who are behind us kind of shows us that, like, we're not being insane about this.
No, we're not being insane and we're not being unreasonable. And I think I really have to commend our union leadership for how they set the table for us months before the negotiations even began to say, look, this is the playing field. This is the playbook. This is what we recognize we have to correct. These are the problems that you have told us. Here is the fix that we have devised for these problems. And here is what it's going to cost. And none of that seemed unreasonable. And then they also, I think, rather brilliantly said, here are things we know that are problems that can't be dealt with in negotiation. And so that has focused us in a way that I haven't seen in a union action in town, as an observer at least, because we not only know what we need to win, we're not wasting time arguing over things that cannot be achieved by this action. And so I think that is going to make it a lot easier for us as a union to recognize victory when we're handed a deal that is a fair deal. And there's not going to be people saying, but what about this? And it's like, well, we can't address that. So let's not get mad that we didn't get the sky. We got something. We're going after something that isn't unreasonable and that any rational deal maker shouldn't have a problem with, unless their whole thing is, well, we can't give them everything because then how are they ever going to respect us? And so there's a little bit of this sort of theater that we have to do on both sides before an impasse is reached. And yeah, that's, I think I drifted from what your question was at that point, but this all goes into my mouth.
I mean, but that is like an incredibly level-headed way of looking at this. And you're absolutely right. I had forgotten about the conversation about like the stuff that we is not achievable in this negotiation. And like, yes, we have to table some things for next time. And that sort of definitely does put us all on the same page. That's really smart. Okay, the thing I wanted to talk to you about is, look, you are out there pretty much every day. You've seen what's going on the picket lines. And you tweeted recently about the gist of it was, hey, pre-WGA writers, don't give your scripts to people on the picket line.
I don't want to use names. I don't want to embarrass anybody who might be listening to this because it's a faux pas. But there was someone at a gate that I was at, and he came by one day and he wanted to buy pizza, and he also wanted someone to hear his pitch. And we kind of I think it ended up we didn't have to hear the pitch, but there have been a couple other people who I've talked to who have said someone has kind of shown up over eager attempting to network, and it's kind of ended badly for them. And I think it's great that a lot of writers who aren't in the union, who have yet to be hired professionally, are showing up, and they're putting in their time. I have seen, we're in week seven, and some people are saying stuff that is a little ridiculous on Twitter, like the pre-WGA is actually more valuable to this action than WGA. And I saw someone say that, and kind of going on about how we should be more grateful to them, and I'm like, I didn't think it was worth it to put them on blast because I did look and I'm like, oh, this guy has 70 followers. I don't think it's fair to like put him on blast to the entire WGA, who would not take too kindly to that statement. But that is not a helpful statement when you're saying, hey, we're the best ones there. I also think, and I'm probably going to get some blowback on this one, I do see some people talking about, hey, what do we do about the people who aren't on the picket lines? Like, how do we get some retribution from them, or what are we doing? And I'm like, I don't think it's helpful to put anybody on blast. There are people who have their own reasons for maybe not walking the picket lines, and to waste energy talking about everybody who isn't out there, be they visible or not visible members of our union, I don't think is a productive use of our energy at this point, because it makes the conversation about those people. And I think we have done an extremely good job of keeping conversation focused on, the working writers who are walking the lines, the writers who stand to benefit from this deal. And I don't necessarily know if a firing squad for a couple big time writers who, yeah, maybe it'd be nice to see some of them pick up the sign and walk more. I don't know if that's a productive conversation, nor do I think it's productive to get into argument over who is the most pure person on the picket lines. We're all there for a reason. We're all finding time to come. And certainly one of the benefits to going there is you can meet some of your peers or even your idols. And there are ways to get something out of that interaction that don't involve getting them to read your script.
So, I think you're absolutely right. Like, there There are opportunities to be had from this. I remember hearing even 15 years ago about like picketing is a great networking opportunity. I think most of us are not going into it that way. We are, like you said, getting a chance to catch up with peers and with people whose work we've enjoyed. But if people are looking at it as a network opportunity, what are some ways they can do that without being maniacs who are trying to tell people their pitches or hand over scripts?
Usually what happens is there's some form of someone, recognizes me or my sign, which happened last week at Warner Brothers. I was walking around and I hear from behind me, "Hey, are you the Bitter script reader?" I'm like, yeah, I saw your sign. Oh, and, what do you think?" And that's cool when they approach, because usually everybody who's approached me has been very nice and friendly. And, they often say they like the show or they like the Twitter and "Oh, hey, well, what do you work on? What do you?" And I find out, there's been some pre-WGA who've been there. There've been a lot of people who are like lower level writers, a couple upper level writers who sometimes are like, "Oh, I've learned so much from you." And that's where that my brain kind of explodes a little bit. But a lot of people on the lines are friendly. And one thing I found is, especially I think TV writers, because they're accustomed to being in a room and being social, are often more open to talking and holding court. And just going on about the sorts of things they've worked on. Film writers, there once or twice I've run into a couple film writers who I really admire, and they're a little put off at, like, not put off, but they're a little surprised at being recognized. I like, "Oh, hey, you do this." And I've learned good lesson for networking: not everybody is that social. It's great to go up to people and say, "Hey, I'm a big fan." Always kind of be ready to figure out your exit out. Like, if you get that vibe of like, "Hey, I'm not the most social person," like, "Hey, I just wanted to tell you, loved your thing, right? All right, I'll leave you alone." And sometimes they'll go, no, wait, walk with me, talk to me. What's your story? What do you work on?" And that's a great way in. I mean, a lot of people wear name tags. At Disney, we wear name tags almost every day. A few people have fallen out of that. And then I went over to Warner Brothers and I reached for the name tags and they were like, "Captains only." And so I kind of keep putting them on blast, because like the best thing that happens at Disney is everybody's wearing a name tag and everybody figures out who everybody is. So I hope that they fix that at Warner Brothers, where everybody is getting a name tag, because they have so many people over there. It could only increase the effectiveness of that. But just be you, the best way to network in any situation is to not seem like you want something out of the encounter. And I went through, the list of writers who I had met exclusively on the picket lines, in some case included people who I knew via Twitter but hadn't met in person. And I came up with 35 earlier this week, and then the more I like added it up, I was probably in the 40s in terms of just, that's averaging out to about one encounter a day on the picket lines of somebody that I had not met personally and had like some kind of substantial conversation with that went beyond, "Oh, hey, who are you? What do you work on?" And some of those are from people who I have the advantage because they recognize me, or they know the show I'm working on, and that's a conversation starter. A couple times you're just walking there with people, and I was walking with an older gentleman, and we were just chatting about this and that, and I said, "So what did you get your start on?" And he said, "Oh, you wouldn't know the show. You're too young to know it, but I was on the show called Growing Pains." And I'm like, "Growing Pains? I watched that every day after school. I watched it when it was on ABC. I know Growing Pains." And so then it was a 2-hour conversation during which we talked about, I was asking about Growing Pains, and he had worked on, his resume was like a who's who of 90s sitcoms, and many that I had not seen, but because there weren't as many shows back then, like he could pull out something like Rock, and I go, "Oh yeah, no, I know Rock. I hadn't watched Rock, but I know." And some interesting stories there. And so that was kind of fascinating, talking to somebody who had been around so much and who also there was like the common ground of their work. And that was, and he did not know me from Adam, to use the expression, obviously. He did not know I was a Twitter guy or anything like that. He was just making conversation with someone on the line. And I've seen him a bunch of times since, and we just pick up, like, "Oh, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of this?" And then, yeah. And then there were a couple other people who I, had the fortune of running into, who were writers on shows that I very much admire. And every now and then, I get the thing where I go up to them and I go, "Oh, hey, are you?" And they're startled at being recognized. And then that draws them into a conversation about this show or that show. And always interesting. But then in one of those, they were talking about an episode, and I said the episode title. And the guy was like, "Oh, you're one of those fans. You know the episode titles." But it was delightful. We ended up he was walking laps and I was manning a gate, and he actually stopped to walk the gate with me, and he stuck around for over an hour. And at a certain point, because we had traced through about four shows he had done and people he'd worked with and all of that, he's like, "This is a nice walk down memory lane. I didn't expect this when I started this conversation." So for me, a lot of this networking has ended up, just meeting writers I admire and talking to them about themselves, which is usually I assume, a pleasant situation for them, because it's saying, "Here's why you're a genius, and here's why this."
But it is, I mean, I think what it's coming down to, and it feels like the biggest lesson that I know, like we've put this out as far as like lessons for networking in general, but it applies to the picket line too, is like be a genuinely nice and curious person. Like you are meeting these people and you want to hear about their experiences because you love TV. That's why most of us got into this business, is we love TV. So yeah, you can talk to the people who made it.
There's nothing that I am asking for out of that encounter than just like, "Oh, hey, what was it like to work on this show?" Or, "How did you do this?" And the stories behind the scenes. When I would give advice about networking, in the before times, I would always get like pushback from some people who didn't know how to do it. It's like, "Well, it feels so ingenuine. Like, you're just like making friends to advance your career." And I'm like, "If that's what you think networking is, you're going to fail at it." I have successfully used like my Twitter and my presence. I do not want to use the word fame, because I'm known very well in a small group of people who, when they congregate, I've been in spaces with people at like blacklist parties, and a friend of mine would enjoy where I would go up to like a writer there and say, "Hey, we follow each other on Twitter," and they would go, Oh, who are you?" And when I'd say "Bitter Script Reader," they were always like, "Oh, so nice to meet you." Like, I had a friend who loved watching me pull that at every party. But someone was like, "Oh, you're famous." I'm like, "I'm not famous. I am known to a lot of people in a very small sphere, and I happen to be moving through that sphere where they're going to know me." But it opens doors, because there's a familiarity there. But anyway, where I was going with this was, you can't approach networking as like, "I'm going to go to this event, I'm going to meet someone who's going to read my script, they are going to get my script made into a movie or TV show, and that is why I'm going to this sole event so that my TV show can be made." That never gets you anywhere. What you do in any event where you're networking, whether it's on a picket line or a mixer or anything, is you're looking to meet like-minded people. And those people can be very supportive to you over the next several years, maybe, or it's someone you meet right then, or it's someone who you meet and 3 years later, you're up for a writer's job on a show that they were on, and you can say, "Oh, hey, you remember me? Oh, yeah, of course." But it's not a quick one-to-one, "I'm going to do this and I'm going to get a benefit from it." I met Through Twitter, I met Jeff Lieber and got to know him really well. And then it was 2.5 years before I actually got a job on one of his shows. And the similar story with basically every job I've gotten via Twitter. You can point to Twitter as the instigation, but it was never like I met someone and 2 weeks later they were hiring me. It was meeting someone was the beginning of a relationship, and much further down the line in the course of that relationship, it paid off in a career way. And so, if you're going to the lines to meet people, the goal should be to be social, to possibly make somebody who make friends with someone who you could stay in contact with, but don't expect it. Because for every person you meet, maybe 1 in 10 you're really going to click with. I've said I've met 40 some people. I haven't really exchanged like email addresses or any of that. Now, some of them are people who I know on Twitter, and yeah, I could reach them that way. But there's never a point where I'm like, "Oh, here's my card," or "We should go get coffee." It's just having interesting conversations with people, and then if we run into each other in similar spheres later, there's like the foundation of a relationship, and hopefully every one of those encounters has been pleasant. But you shouldn't look at it as like, "This is how I'm going to benefit immediately from doing this," because you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yes, that's a great that you put it better than I ever could. The other thing I wanted to ask about is this just occurred to me when you mentioned meeting this some of these writers where they worked on shows where you could pull the title of the show. I know that Warner Brothers had a celebration of the WB. Was that last week or a couple weeks as of this recording? Yeah.
That was about a week ago as we're recording this.
And this is, I was looking at that and I didn't get to make it out for that, but it was like, just to give it some context, it was a celebration of the WB and its heyday. writers from shows, actors from shows that were on the WB network at the time. And I believe you were there, right?
I was there, yes.
Because like you have a deep love of these shows and like how do you go to these things and not act like a fan, you know? Or do you? Like, does it matter?
I do. I do. The answer is I do. No, it happened at that one where I'd also gone to the superhero one because there I was getting to go as kind of a professional, and I still turned into a fan there. But the WB one was fun because it was a lot of writers there and a few actors, Jason Bear and Sherry Appleby from Roswell were both there. And so it was kind of funny about, I was walking around. I'm a Roswell fan, obviously, because I'm old school WB fan. And I saw them and I'm like, oh, I really want to go up for a picture, but I felt like less nervous going up to, I'm I can't even remember who I had gone up to right before that, who was a writer. There was certainly substantial writers who I had no problem going up and saying hi, but like, oh, can I go over? And eventually, the friend I was with disappeared. I think they kind of ditched me so that I would not feel like I was going to fall on my face in front of them. And I went over and I just, said hello to Sherry Appleby and said I was a fan, and I got a picture with her, and then went over to Jason Bear and ended up in a conversation with him as we were walking back and forth for about 20, 25 minutes. He was the nicest guy in the world. And that was funny because he had also done Supergirl, and he immediately saw my Superman hat and he was like, oh, are you a writer on there? Oh, no, I was. And so we talked about that, and I told him I was a fan, and I got a picture with him too. And yeah, you do kind of fan out a little bit. And the really cool one, notice I'm being careful about saying, oh, the writers I run into, the actors, I will just drop names left and right. The really cool one was at the superhero day at WB. And so everybody in sort of like, Arrowverse, Berlanti Land showed up, but people from other shows showed up as well. And I, at one point, was with a couple writers from our show, and I saw that Brandon Routh and his wife Courtney Ford were sort of off to the side. And I was like, do we want to go get a picture with Brandon Routh? And everybody else was like, I don't know. I'm like, I'll go over there. I'll say hi. Me, Mr. Bold. And so I'm walking over, and just before I even have a chance to introduce myself, Courtney Ford goes, you're the Bitter script reader. And I just said, Courtney, you didn't make my day. You made my week right here. And, because I have not met her. I've not met her or Brandon in person. She followed me on Twitter and we had a couple interactions, but nothing major. And then, I said, oh, that was good to meet you. And then Brandon, because I'm a notorious Superman Returns fan, I think it's one of the best Superman movies, and I often say so online. And I had just recently shown it to my son and tweeted a little bit about that experience. Brandon was like, oh yeah, I saw you were showing your son the movie. I thought that was so cool. I was on a plane. I almost was going to respond to that. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. Superman, no, he says, I love your show too. Your show is really great. And I'm like, oh, it's great. And so we talked to him, like, can I get a picture with you guys? And then invited the other writers over. Like, can we get a picture? They could not have been nicer. And yeah, that's a moment where you just kind of accept you're going to fan out. And they made it much less embarrassing because they recognized me, and it was very fun. So, as in terms of cool encounters in the line, that is pretty far up there. Most of the time, when I see actors in the line, I sort of let them be until they end up in my circle. There was one point I realized I had been walking for half an hour and constantly crossing Alyssa Milano, and I had not like registered that fact until I saw the name tag. So most of the time I leave them be, but every now and then, if it's someone who you're a fan of, and especially on WB Day, you're like, okay, they came here on WB Day. They kind of know what they're in for. Yeah, you just, again, it's the same rule as I was saying earlier. You go up, you say your pleasantries if you want to compliment their work, but also like don't take up too much of their time. And if they want to talk to you, they're like, oh yeah, let's talk. Like with Jason Bear, I was just kind of went over and said hi and that I was a fan. It was good to see him. And he was like, oh, your show, let's talk about that. And the next thing I knew, I'd been walking with him for 25 minutes. So that's a good example of how it happens organically. And sometimes it's like, oh, hey, nice to meet you. And oh, sure, get a picture. Cool. And that's that. But yeah, it is funny going to those and trying not to fan out. And that the superhero day, because so many of the writers of the Berlanti shows hadn't met each other, but we were all aware of each other, that was kind of fun because I kept getting recognized by people. And this was the one point where I'm like, oh, I'm more known than I thought I was known, because there were a couple of writers from Gotham Knights who were like, you're Adam, right? Hey, no, nice to meet you. I followed you a long time, and a couple of us from the show. Oh, hey, you're, like, oh, wow, okay. This is a little surprising. I did not realize that I was that recognized, and that they had followed for that long. But yeah, I'm trying to think if there's another good fan encounter. I mean, certainly people come up to me and make me and oh, I read your blog, or I read that thing you tweeted the other day, and that's always kind of fun. It's really fun when they recognize, like, oh, I saw your episode.
That's always a good way in.
It's a good way in. No, I was at Disney at the front gate one day, and I was talking to somebody, and I must have introduced myself, and David Goodman was about 5 feet away from me, and he heard me say my name, and he goes, oh yeah, you're Adam Allinger, I follow you. And so we were, entering and talking very seriously about, union politics and all of that. And somewhere in there, I quoted Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and that immediately turned the conversation to a geek conversation. And then somewhere in there, the penny dropper, he like, oh, you're also the Bitter script reader. Oh yeah, no, I really know you now. And I was like, that has never happened, where I have been recognized as Adam and someone has been excited to see me. And then I get recognized as Bitter and they're like, oh, I also know you. Like, I had never had that happen before. Usually they know me from one or the other. And but it was a really great conversation with David Goodman. That was another one of those really fun ones that you have on
That's
the
great.
lines.
And I think, like to sort of put a point on this is like the thing you keep coming back to is these are organic interactions. These things come up in like you were seeking some out, you were not seeking some out, but the times when, it lasted more than a minute to say, hey, I love your work or I think you're great, it's happened very organically. Both of you have invited a conversation.
And it's a thing that I try to be conscious of, because there's one way you could do it where you have a very captive audience. If you're walking a gate with someone and you guys are trapped at that gate, you could very easily become an irritant. And so I always do try to like have that moment of, oh, okay, well, I'll leave you alone or that. And then it's like, no, talk. That kind of invites you into a longer conversation. And I'm like, okay, well, you've chosen to, stick around at this gate, or you've chosen to, like, keep me here. I don't feel like I'm irritating you. And then, like I said, it usually turns into like a half hour thing about why I thought they were great, or their work was great, or whatever.
Right, which no one is ever sorry to hear.
No one is ever sorry to hear. No, if you're going to come up and tell me I thought your episode was great, I would be in the exact same thing. But there were a couple writers who I'd recognized who were kind of walking the circuit, and like I kept trying to like say hi, and one day I was even like, oh, hello, nice to see you. And they're like, all right. And some people have a very don't bug me vibe, and I just try to respect that. And that writer happened to also be acquainted with somebody else I knew who was walking another day, and so he made sure that I got introduced to this gentleman. And even that didn't fully break the ice. What broke the ice was, hey, I know this person who worked on your show. They were a friend. And then they lit up and they were like, oh, I love them. And then that melted it and it thawed. So like, you do have to be kind of good at reading people and understanding, like, okay, even though I've said hi to you and there's been a pleasantry here, let's make sure I'm not, interrupting your day. Some people do just want to come to the lines to walk, put in their time, and they're not social people. And that is 100% okay. And so definitely respect that if you realize you're in the company of someone who's like, look, man, I just want to listen to Mo's book and while on tape while I'm walking,
I think that's a great point. And if you are the kind of person who has trouble reading others, I'd say just go in having that exit strategy, like you talked about. Like go in, say, I wanted to meet you. I think you're great, but be ready to walk away as soon as you can, unless invited to stay.
Yeah, and usually, like, I'm sure I have been on the other side of it, where someone comes up and they're like, well, oh, hey, now tell me about you. What show do you work on? And it's interesting, meeting a lot of writers who come up in kind of the same class as I did, who got, staffed around the same time as I did, because they're all kind of dealing with the same struggle of like, I'm on a 10 episode show, and it was a year between seasons, and I had to jump from this show to that show. And there's certainly like, yeah, that you can meet a lot of your idols there, but there's also a lot to be learned from like talking to other writers at your level and recognizing like, oh shit, yeah, these are real issues, or how are you handling this? Well, I got onto this show because I had worked with this co-EP and they got staff. Like, just getting like nuts and bolts of business advice is also a good thing there. I mean, I've certainly talked a lot about the excitement of meeting people, but there's a lot that you can get out of an interaction from someone who you haven't heard of, who is just also a writer on either a similar show to yours or a very different show. And I'm walking with a lot of writers who work on kids shows, and so sometimes when they're talking about work, it's kind of interesting learning, how they break story or how much time, they have to do an episode or things like that. So there's also ways you can kind of learn a lot more about the business too, beyond just these cool encounters where you name drop.
Thank you. I'm going to drop a name right now. Thank you to the very famous celebrity Adam Mallinger.
Oh, don't do that.
We will come and stalk you at both Disney and WB. Hopefully we'll see you this week.
All right. Thank you. Union song, union battle. All at it up. One is all what we got now. Union song, union battle. All at it up. One is all what we got now. I can't even start to look around me here.
That was bitter script reader Adam Mallinger. Next up, a really terrific craft-centered conversation with writer Karen Gracchi. Karen is so great, so funny, so personable, and this is a really terrific, like really specific focused conversation about point of view. I asked Karen what she wanted to talk about on the podcast, and she jumped right on this. You will hear her list off her credits at the beginning of it, but some that you should know if you are worried about jumping into this. Tuca and Birdie, probably her biggest adult credit that you know, but she's also worked on the Harper House. She's the story editor on the new show Haley's On It, which is a really fun show. She's killing it on that. This is, I really enjoyed this conversation. Loved meeting Karen. I hope you will enjoy this too. We have these kinds of craft conversations all the time over on benblacker.substack.com. Follow over there, check out some of the newsletters that I've written, but also join for the Q&As with pro writers, which you get to attend and ask the questions by becoming a paid subscriber. Once again, that's benblacker.substack.com. Thanks for listening.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
Karen, thank you so much for chatting today. I'm going to let the folks know, in fact, why don't you let the folks know where they may have seen your name on their television screens in the past, because it is a long and illustrious list of shows.
You're very sweet. It could be adult animation. It could be kids animation. It could be live action. So it would be Girl Boss. It would be Tuca and Birdie. It would be Haley's On It, which is now new and out on Disney Plus. It could also be Harper House. And then I have a bunch of stuff I've written that no one's ever seen.
As we all do.
Sometimes the best stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So in today's craft conversation, we're going to talk about point of view. And the way I sort of want to lead into that is to ask you, you've worked on a bunch of these different kinds of shows. I assume you are not solely writing shows that are about you. So like,
correct.
Tell us first, let's talk about maybe just pick a couple of these shows as examples. But like, how are you writing characters who are not you? And then how are you finding your way into those characters?
That's a great question. Yes, I have no one has asked me or has any interest in my autobiographical story. So yeah, in terms of like, let's say Tuca and Birdie, Lisa Hanawalt's the showrunner, who is fantastic. And she had an idea of who she wanted Tuca and Birdie to be, like their general sense of self, even though they were half birds, half women. She really had them like grounded in emotion and feeling and the lens through which they saw the world. And that really interests me. So when you're coming into a situation with a showrunner or a creator like Lisa, who has a general idea, I find the benefit of the writer's room then is, what's your experience that you can bring to the table about these characters? Birdie was very flustered, very neurotic, very nervous, a worrier, always in her head, overthinking. Whereas, Tuca was just all bravado, all action first, thinking second. And I relate to a lot more of Birdie than Tuca. But at the same time, it was so fun to explore people who aren't you, because that's like the best.
Right. That's why we do this, right? You know,
right.
Some of us are not actors, and this is a way to be someone else for a little while.
Exactly. And my background is all performance. So I actually come to it that way as like, it is fun to put on that character and figure it out. Like, what would she do? Because it's not necessarily what I would do, but wouldn't it be fun to be her for a day?
Totally. And then what about some of these kids shows or even YA shows? Like, how do you find your way into those characters? And then we can sort of switch to talk about how those characters interact with the world.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, a lot of times when I've come onto a show, like I'm essentially like the head writer for Haley's on it. And I feel like, you know, when the show was sold by Nick Stanton and Devin Bungie were great showrunners. They were like, they had an idea of who the characters were, the leads at least. So, but for me, when I'm coming on then as story editor on the animation side is to be able to be like, yeah, but why do they do these things? And to me, that's where I come in. That's where the writers come in is like, yes, she might be hesitant, but why is she hesitant? And to get real specific, especially on the comedy side, I mean, you know, like, the more specific it is, the better. And so we could think of like real world examples of like, why is she this way though? Like, it's not just because she's 14. Everybody's 14, but not everybody is like this. So we get to decide, and it's fun just taking shots. You know, the writers, we often say a lot, like, you know, they don't have to take, the showrunners don't have to take your pitch, but you have to make a pitch and you have to believe in it, right? It's not your job to decide it, that's theirs, but it's your job to have a point of view on these characters' point of view, so to speak, you know? And it's my favorite part of creation is getting into the why.
So specifically, like, what did you discover about Haley in this show that like wound up being sort of keystones for you, you know, that opened up this character for you?
Yeah, I think what's the key is like she's making this list of things that she's hesitant to do. And it was like, yeah, but a keystone for us was realizing like, oh, she hasn't just been making this list for like a few months. She's been making this list for years. And that was like a big deal. It's like, oh, so she's always been this girl who's been like, someday I'll do this cool thing, but today I'm just going to have a day. And like, you know, she procrastinates. And so, and she's happy thinking about things that could be, but not doing them. And so it's this whole series is about pushing her out of her comfort zone in every way. It is like, it is the opposite of a sweatpants during the pandemic. And it is like doing all those things you absolutely don't want to do. And you're going to do them right now because you have to. And oh my God, I'm a better person now because of it. I like, you know, it's funny when I first came on the show, to be honest with you, I was like, how am I going to relate to this as much just because it's a kid's show? And I realized like every year I make resolutions and every year I don't do them. So I was like, yeah, that's pretty applicable. So that's been my, that was my initial in, was being like, oh, I relate to that. I relate to that a lot.
And so it's one thing to sort of find your personal way into these characters, but then I feel like there's a moment, especially when it comes to actually writing the scripts, that you have to consider the character's point of view and the experiences that they have that you don't, or that you have that they don't. Right. And you're writing to their worldview. So like,
yes,
let's try to drill down on that for a minute. And, you know, I think probably Haley's is a good example, because you are talking about a character who is like pretty different from you. She is a young kid. We've been through that, but also like she lives in a different world. How do you start to draw with the writers or on the page the parameters of her worldview?
Because I have a performance background, I literally always come to character, whether it's a lead in my own work or in something I'm creating for somebody else or on a writer's room. It's what is their thing? Like, and I know that sounds so simple, but like literally, what is the sound that they make? Because like when I'm improvising, that to me is the strongest choice I can make when I come on stage. It's not, I don't try to have the whole world figured out. I don't know where the scene's going to go, but I know if I come on stage and I go like, that's my character, right? Like that is the essence of who this character is. And no matter what happens, that is only going to get heightened and challenged and explored. So I think that's Haley's sound. At the end of the day, that's her. She's like, unsure. Whereas the other lead, Scott, is very much like, woohoo! Like that is his core is, it's all going to be a fine. We're having a great time. We'll figure it out. I'm kind of oblivious. You know, but he's woohoo no matter what. And so when and woohoo are together, he plays very well. And so even when we were making, there's a smaller character, one of Haley's like uncles, who is, you know, it could have been a very nothing character. We knew nothing about him, just that he owned a boat. And we had pitched in the room, what if he hates the boat? What if he resents this boat? And he's always like, ugh. And like, that is the core of that character to me, is no matter when we write him, all I think and feel is, ah. So he's always like, hey kids, do you want to buy this boat? And they're like, we're 14. And like, so that, like, no matter when I see him, I'm going to heighten that. And then someone thinks they're going to buy the boat from him. And he's like, yeah. But then at the core of it, they're not gonna. And he's like, ugh. And so I know that sounds so simple, but to me, it really is like, what is the core of their emotion? Because I think, like you, I've heard you say in previous podcasts that you play from emotion and in character too. And that's the only way I know how to do it, is to be true to that core sound.
It's so interesting. And it's such a great, like, first building block to creating a character, especially for like new writers who are working on their samples right now.
Like, yes,
having that core sound is really, it's a great idea. Did you have that on like Tuca and Birdie too?
Yes. You know, it's funny, because when I was on Tuca and Birdie, I didn't have as much status in the room, so I could suggest, you know, but I was a lower level writer. And so like, I definitely could, when we're pitching smaller characters. Now I feel that I have more, a little more status, a little more power in the room. I could play with those things more, from a top down level, being like, what does this guy sound like? What does he feel like? How does he see the world? You know, I like to think of it as playing. I like everyone to just feel like in the writer's room, it's a safe place and they can throw out terrible ideas that really are going to go nowhere. But at the time, you don't even know that. Like, there's no judgment, because it's like, well, we're just going to build on everything, because I come from improv. That's the only way I feel safe knowing how to work. I think when people are judged and criticized on every word that comes out of their mouth, it puts everybody in their head. And I can't even imagine. So I like to have the freedom to sound like an idiot. So I want other people to have the freedom to sound like an idiot. But I will tell you, like, we wrote a recent character was a clerk, and it was just a clerk in the store, and it's just like a transactional interaction. But to me, everybody has to have this thing. And so the pitch on the table was, what if he was, yeah, right, like, you're ever going to find that thing? We haven't seen that thing in like 100 years. And he like makes that sound like multiple times. And I think it's in most of my work, is you'll see that character repeating a sound. Trying to find that for the biggest characters, which sometimes I don't have any leeway in doing because they've already been created, but also the ones we're bringing in, like, what is this?
Yeah, that's cool. That's really neat. I think there's something too. I mean, listen, I worked on an animated show for many years, and I remember conversations in the room about, like, this was Puss in Boots and it takes place in some, you know, unknown historical time, and like jokes about French fries. Like, could we make those jokes? Do these characters know what French fries are? Like, I'm curious about those perspective jokes and sort of the scope of the character's perspective when you know how far to push it. And when you have to hold back.
Yeah. And I, you know, a lot of times, the perspective that I've had in a lot of comedy rooms is let him kill it. Meaning like, we're going to put it in, we're going to pitch it, we're going to see how far it could go. And on the kid's side, it's like, will S&P let us do it? Like, there's a joke that's in Haley's on it where there's this really good looking guy named Logan. And the girls are like, look at Adam. And he's like strong and buff and he's so cool. And they're like, Logan models belts. And they're like, yeah, he does. Like, and that made it. We're like, how can we say that he's like really good looking and he has like a kind of a sexy job without saying sexy job at a kid's show? He models belts. So there you have it. So I guess for us, it's trial and error. But a lot of times it's also like, all right, is it being true to character? Like a lot of times there's some jokes we could make and we've made that haven't made the script because ultimately they're just mean-spirited. It's not the tone of the show. Like the shows, even To Good Birdie, even the adult shows, Harper House, and now Haley's on it, I would say they're not cynical. So I think a lot of times there's a tendency to be like, but that's really, in the case of the shows I've been on, it hasn't been the voice of the characters. It might be the voice of a few writers, but it's not the voice of the show. And ultimately, even if they're funny, they don't make it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember talking to a writer once who was writing for the Muppets, and the conversations she had in the room about like how to write from the Muppets perspective, and like they were doing, I can't remember what the specifics are, but they were doing a scene where like Rolf the dog was really down, and I think the joke they eventually came up with was like, yeah, I've got mange. This is a character specific joke, right? And I'm wondering about like those discoveries along the way, like when you inhabit Haley or Tuca and Birdie or whoever, finding those character specific references and the things that affect that character in a real way, because you have to play the reality.
Oh yeah. And I mean, you know, from your work too, I'm sure it's like you play the crazy straight and you play the straight crazy. So like in Haley,
well, let's stop here for a second, because that is, I want to talk about this, because I feel like, yes, in my work, I do this all the time, but we don't talk about it very much. Explain to folks what you mean by that.
Well, what I mean by that is, like, if something is absolutely bananas, like, let's say there's a newscaster and he's broadcasting about there's, you know, unicorns taking over the world, and it's absolutely, you know, they're eating each other and there's fire and there's, you know, and the more seriously he can take it and broadcast it like a news story, the funnier it'll be, right? So to me, that's like, you know, because it's so real. You're trying to make something that is so bananas palpable and real. And that's where the comedy will come. And then if it's super straight, you play it as silly as possible. You know, if it's, something is so boring, you know, that's, what is that? The Minister of Silly Walks? Like, I like, what is that from? You know, it's just like little things like that where you make the mundane silly and you make the straight stuff, you know, go over the top. That to me is what I enjoy the most. And so like we have a character, Scott in the show. And like I said, his essential nature is woohoo, but he has a real fear of werewolves. And when we talk about it, he gets real serious. Like he's a truther. Like, you guys, this is nothing to joke about, you know? And so because it's like werewolves, which is something fantastical, we can play the ridiculous straight. And so, you know, but the more serious he takes it and the more, you know, matter of fact he is about it, the better it works. And, you know, and to be honest, like we have to do that in To Good Birdie to make the characters as realistic as possible. You know, that's a show of like talking birds, talking plants. And we spent a long time on making Speckle, who was played by Steven Yeun, like the boyfriend, who's a robin, like making him as grounded as possible. Like, how can we make him not a doormat, but also like really relatable and real? And like, so there you're taking a fantastical thing. This guy is a bird and a man in an animated show. But I think part of the reason for that show's appeal to like fans in a real way is because people saw themselves in these bird people, because it was played as real as possible. Like, we tried to make them as real as possible. So it was so gratifying then on Twitter for people to be like, I am that plant. Like, I feel seen by this toucan, you know, like, because it's like we try to ground the ridiculous in real feelings and really relatable stuff.
I think there's so much comedy that comes out of that too, right? Like that's the
right,
the source of humor. And I'm remembering, I know Lisa did this on BoJack, but like there's also the specificity of these characters being animals, that like they have different wants and likes and, you know, habits than we do. Do you remember conversations about those in the room on that show specifically? Like, how are these characters different from us?
Yeah, you know, it went back to like when we saw first animatic of Tuca, it was really important. They had to really figure out how her beak moved, like how a real toucan's beak moved, because it informed how the rest of her body moved. Because, you know, obviously toucans don't usually have also a human body. So, yeah, exactly. So it was cool to see the animatic to see like, oh, but if her head moves this way, then her beak really is opening straight up to the sky. And that's a different kind of expression than other things. So like just the very physicality of what, how a bird actually moves, and trying to keep that as authentic as possible, then also considering she's part human, was really, really cool. Like I think I enjoyed seeing function meet, you know, reality in that one. Like, how is she really going to move? So that from the very beginning, so that was very interesting to me.
That's really neat. Is this all of this stuff? It feels like we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording, but like you've had all of this comedy training with IO and UCB and Second City rather, and like,
yeah,
it feels like all of this stuff culminates now in the work that you're doing. I'm curious to hear about like how some of that comedy training has set you up for your current job.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's funny. I think when you read a person's bio, it seems like their whole life is pretty linear, meaning like, oh, they did this and they did this. It seems like just a straight progression that led them from one place to another. Yeah, mine was not that. I feel like I was enjoying what I was doing and trying to be as good at it as I could in the hopes that it would lead to something. Like, so when I was doing improv and sketch at Second City in Chicago and tour with the touring company, and then, you know, in Las Vegas performing for them, I really felt like, okay, well, this will lead to something, right? I didn't know if that would be like a sketch kind of show, or if it would be like writing, or if it would be performance. I actually thought when I moved to LA, I'd do more work as an actor. And I worked in commercials and stuff, but I actually found more momentum on the writing side. So, and that was a new challenge that kept being appealing to me. When LA feels like a war of attrition, like how long can you afford to live here? you know, you kind of go with the horse that's moving. And in my case, the horse that was moving was writing.
Was there at that time in your life, was there a discernible difference for you between improvising and acting and writing?
Yes. I mean, I didn't want to move to LA and do the exact same thing I had done in Chicago. You know, I didn't want to like come here and just do a repeat of what I had done. I was teaching and performing and I really loved it. But both my husband and I moved here to be like the small fish in the huge pond and just see if we could make it. He's also a writer, a performer. And so I think when I was acting, I kind of felt last on the food chain. I didn't get a lot of traction on the theatrical side. I did more commercial stuff, but I always felt like, I want to participate more in the process before it gets handed to me, if that makes any more sense. And I actually, thanks to I worked as an assistant for many years to a director named Rodrigo Garcia. And because of that, I learned everybody's job in production, and I could figure out by process of elimination, okay, I know I don't want to do that. I don't want to be line producer because I don't want to deal with schedules and budgets. But I did do some producing for him, associate producing and then producing. And I realized, like, again, I like this, but the thing I liked the most was writing. So for me, it was like elimination. And then realizing that the thing I felt most creatively inspired by over and over, challenged by, scared by, and that I actually thought I might have a chance of making a living at consistently, or at least try to, was writing. And luckily it's still going. I mean, I would hate to tell my kids it was over. We're leaving.
It was a good run. So as far as like that training you did as a performer, and we've talked a little bit about this already, but like, let's get into it a bit more. Like, what are techniques that you learned then that you now apply to the writing side?
Yeah, for me, it all comes from character. I like in a sketch, there's some idea that tickles me, like some idea that makes me laugh that I can't seem to shake. It rolls around like a marble in my brain. And those are the scripts that eventually become scripts. You know, there was a sketch I wrote, a Second City, called Glengarry Glen Girl Scout. And I just like the, I mean, you know what it is just by talking, but the idea of it, like, made me laugh just thinking about it. Like, oh yeah, what if it was Kool-Aid? What if she had a clear backpack and she had things she took up? Like, and then like little things would come to me, same things with script. So now it's just like, I don't think a lot about lore, which I know a lot of people do, but what I tend to think about more is like, huh, that'd be funny. And then if it sticks with me, maybe I'll be standing in Ralph's a few days later and I'll be staring at like Frosted Mini Wheats and I'll be like, oh yeah, but what if she had a brother? And then like, you know, and so then I feel like it's like, I had read an article when I was like younger where Judy Blume was talking about how she wrote ideas for her books down whenever she had an idea on like a tissue box or like coming out of the shower. And for me as a kid, I was like, oh, you could be a writer like that. Like, I thought a writer has to sit down and like, and that kind of freed me up to be like, oh, I can just be a messy idea generator, which is kind of how I see myself. That if there's something that really sticks with me and delights me, that when I tell my friend about it, oh, I'm working on this script where this happens. And if they laugh, then I'm like, okay, maybe I got something here. And then the world is fun to explore. But if it feels like work or I feel like I'm writing it to write it for somebody else and it's not me, I'm like, why am I doing this? I might as well be an accountant. Too late.
Thank you, Karen Gracci, messy idea generator. That is.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Just perfect. I think so many of us relate to that. We'll wrap up by asking, as we always do, what you are watching on television these days. What's getting you excited or inspired? What are you watching with your kids? Also, I'm always curious about what kids are into.
Yes, what I'm watching, what my kids actually really like right now. Well, my daughter's 13, so she was like, you know, she's watching Shameless. And I'm like, should you be watching this? but my son really likes Kiff. Kiff is a new animated show on Disney as well. And he dug that. I didn't know if he would. He really likes it. And then of course he's playing Fortnite and then it's hard to get him to do anything else. For me, I don't know about you, but like when I watch comedy, a lot of times I feel like I'm kind of working because I'm like, oh, how did they do this? How did they move? Like, you know, with hacks or whatever. But then when I watch, like, so I tend to watch stuff that isn't comedy. So I've been watching, I loved Severance. I loved Beef. Severance, Beef, and oh, The Last of Us. That took everything out of me because I'm such an incredible wuss and I can't handle anything. And I was like, I'm going to do it. I didn't watch Lord of the Rings. I didn't watch Game of Thrones. I'm really going to do this. I'm going to deal with the violence. And I came out the other side. I feel like I'm proud. I'm part of a cultural moment, but it was which was fantastic. It was so good.
That is great. I love it. These are all good answers. You've passed.
Yay!
Karen, thanks so much for chatting today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Ben.